Tower Bridge, 1963, and you at the centre of it all in stockings and knee-high patent leather boots, showing off the round, smooth bump of your baby underneath a geometric shift. And seeing it, I want to trace every minute detail of you as you were then. And so I lift the photograph up to the window, but the light shines through the paper and releases the people around you to carry on with their days. Men in trench coats hurry past, their minds blank, hiding themselves through the increasing translucency of the paper, but you stay fixed in the center, surrounded by the ghosts and mortar of the bridge. Your face is held aloof, although a smile is breaking through the barrier, which makes me think that you knew then what you know now, and I think of you running a bath, lighting candles, listening to rain on the roof, and pouring a glass of wine on New Year's Eve, stripping off, sinking in, and resurfacing. My grandpa was a Jewish German refugee from, well, Germany, and he came over, well, he came to England in 1936, and I wrote, and I'm still writing loads of poems about. So this one, but I guess I'm going to read some poems, kind of, this one I wrote 3 years ago, so I'll read this one first. Operations. After the candles and apple cake, the lights were dimmed and the curtains drawn over the day to find the six of you, Richard, Henry, Peter, Klaus and Werner, gathered together before the white sheet stretched across the archway, dividing the sitting room from the smoking room, where behind the facade your father was having difficulty with the carbon arc, adjusting the distance between two rods. He had lost the current and needed to start again, touching them together, then slowly drawing them apart until incandescent light reached across the gap, to which he began to raise up square slivers of glass that dissolved through the gauze to find you all. The Schlechtensee's aqua reflected the branches and leaves. Birds hovered in suspension between water and sky. Prelude. The house went up in flames when you were at the Weiserhart in Dresden, drinking spa water in the gardens, learning to unfold creases in white napkins. A piece of coal unhooked itself from the brazier. First, it worked on the weave of the carpet, crept upwards to the bookcase, then the smolder reached the music scores, and silent notes stole up the stairs to Erna on the second floor, who disappeared into the smoke. It billowed out onto the street, concealing the white barefooted figure who heard the call of sirens in the distance. I have a slightly longer poem now. It's about, it's called Etty Friedheim, and she would have been my grandfather's great aunt. So I think that makes her my great, great, great aunt. And she emigrated to England in 1893 when she married her husband. And this poem is set in 1930, just after her husband died. And I just imagined what it was like. Emeralds and sapphires and rubies shone like coral underneath the sea, like the sea itself when light brushes the surface, and you could be on a boat or the beach or the promenade and it hits you. She would give it all to go back there, to that day that has slipped from her mind and all but the knowledge that it happened. That there was once such a day, but time had moved too quickly, and now that she was alone, all she could do was walk, and when she walked towards water. She limited herself to small reservoirs, the pond in the park with the old willow tree that she saw in the morning from the bedroom window. And in the afternoon, she would walk there among the ducks and the geese, the whole place a stink, or the green canal stretching out beyond the city, the footpath widening under trees and lined with hedges, where she'd take a parasol and a flask and a blanket, although she never used it. And sometimes the river, when she wanted to be surrounded, she'd walk along, looking down into the grey sludge of low tide. She could not think of setting sail again, of the sea, the sound of the waves crashing against the shore like the heavy sound of his factory, machines pressing pulp into paper, whiteness held within the metallic grips. She had not visited often. Perhaps once a month she would travel with him in the morning in the carriage across town. They would go to his office or to the packing room, and she would watch her husband check the boxes packed the day before. And sometimes as he counted, she would sneak past him, slipping through the door into the room of machines, the sound of metal grinding into her. She had been back there only once since he had gone. She had walked along the canal and after some time found herself outside the huge gates of the factory, and she snuck in, letting the sound of the crushing plates around her. She had loved it. Every December since their first anniversary, they would come here to watch the pressing of the stationery that he designed for her, writing paper and envelopes and notebooks adorned with drawings that grew year upon year. She watched the first vine growing upwards, circling the whole page, tiny rosebuds forming at the edge of stems. The next year they were unfurling, tight curls of petals that opened in full bloom the next year, and soon there were bees and butterflies hovering around them. At some point the vine transformed with bunches of grapes one year and figs the next, and soon the vines gave way to trees, pear trees and pomegranate trees, the leaves falling down the page where the vines had once crept up. The last pages that he drew had olive trees stretching up the sides, and for the first time roots spread out along the bottom, reaching out from the page. She uses this paper to write to her niece in Berlin. She knows it is different now, and that she herself had wanted to leave, that to do something out of choice and not to have a choice are two opposing things, and that the body will crave for the place it cannot be. She cannot tell her what to do, but she tries. Etty puts down her pen and walks to the bathroom, where she fills a jug with water and returns to her desk. She pours a little into the fern on top of her bureau, and the rest she pours into a glass. She takes the glass of water over to the piano, places it onto the lid, and taking a sheaf of paper down from the shelf, sits at the stool, places one on the stand and plays. She does not care what she is playing, but today she plays Bach. She plays herself back to the beginning of sound, where he hands her a heartbeat in C, and she plays the fugue over and over again. She drinks coffee in the afternoon and tries to eat some cake, but instead she puts on her coat and leaves the house and crosses over the road to the park. Each day her walk has gotten longer, but today her legs feel heavy and they take her slowly around. It had taken a long time to reach this point of walking, of breathing. It took weeks for her to consider going outside, but whenever she got up the nerve, it began to rain. It always began to rain and she put it off. There are three types of loneliness, and today she believed she had all three of them. She stopped at a bench and sat down, looked at the trees, thought about how small some of them had been when she first came here, how she had watched it grow but never really seen it like this before. But in her mind, she always thought of it as it had been that first summer. The blossom from the apple and the cherry trees had disappeared, and all around the park, fruit was beginning to appear on the branches. That summer was the best summer she could remember. There had been no rain, or when it rained at night, and they walked around every park in London. Each day they took a carriage to the next one with a picnic basket filled by the kitchen and a blanket, and they'd circle the whole place before choosing a place to sit and watch the whole afternoon pass by. I've got one last poem. So I wrote all these poems about my grandpa, and I started having problems with them, with imagining all this stuff, so then I wrote this poem. I'm writing about my grandfather. On photographs of Lotte, on Ernst Moser's doctoral thesis on the law of dowries and other forms of gifting, the unit gift. I'm talking about conjecture with Robert, on the bank being taxed 86% by 1934, on Hans Rotholz, on the house by the lake and Reifenstahl and the Olympics, on New York and why they didn't make it, on finding the video footage from the Mediterranean cruise they went on with credit from the unused tickets to New York, on how they dined out 40 years later on the remainder of the money, on Benjamin's Berlin childhood around 1900, on why there is so much memoir written about this period of time, on the unknowableness of it, on exile, on writing about an exile so long ago when there are so many in exile now, on a novelist saying that she will not write about the present because she does not see it as a subject, on the privilege of hindsight, on taking the privilege of hindsight for granted, on why some writers must write about the present and some about the past, on why some writers must write about the present because if they didn't, there will be no documents to reference when writers write about the past, on how easy it is to make it all up, on whether that is truthful, on whether truth matters, on whether truth in writing matters, on whether truth in writing is the only thing that matters, on what truth is, on whether truth is objective or whether truth is subjective, on whether there is a universal truth, and if there is a universal truth, whether it is possible to write it or not write it, on whether what is subjectively observed and relayed is universal truth, on what is universally true, on watching an older poet and a younger poet talk about truth, on the older poet wanting to find truth and only that, on the younger poet not believing him, on watching this, on watchmakers, on notes from Peter's memoir, on Jewishness, on the difference between a nation and a state, on Jewishness being a mix of ethnicity, religion, and nationality, on the two times Jews have political autonomy, once from 1350 to 586 BC, again from 140 and 30 to 37 BC, on the Jewish diaspora since 586 BC, on how Jews have lived as minorities in every country they live in except Israel, on whether my family spoke Yiddish, on how the British government agreed to admit 1,000 young survivors from the camps in 1946, but only 732 could be found, on how the first of these survivors went to stay in a hostel in Windermere, on the interment of Ernst and Klaus and Peter, on Peter's real name.